Above Lacrosse. This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX Lacrosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. Rescued after a 911 call for a boat in distress in San Francisco Bay. Fire department patrol boats found nine people aboard a sailboat that was taking on water, eight rescued. The boat captain stayed on the boat. Fire officials say he's an expert, and he and it were towed in. A dual U.S. German citizen arrested and accused of trying to firebomb a U.S. Embassy branch office in Tel Aviv a week ago. Justice Department says gasoline bombs were found in Joseph Neumeier's backpack outside the embassy. On this busy travel weekend at West Virginia's busiest airport, Yeager International, a second collie now patrolling the mile-long airfield to shoo away birds that could get sucked into a jet engine and cause a crash. Russia and Ukraine swapped hundreds more prisoners for a third day today as attacks in the war continue. This is ABC News. Some advice on shopping and getting away. Travel experts say airfare and hotel prices are down to levels not seen since the pandemic. Brian Kelly, founder and head of The Points Guy.
This might be the summer to go to Europe, because every last several years, Europe travel just kept going up and up and up. I've talked to a lot of travel advisors, and even on the hotel front, hotel prices are coming down, and a lot of hotels are offering extra perks. So when you're looking at the price of a hotel, don't just look at the room rate.
Tariffs are already having an effect, says shopping expert Trey Bodge with some advice.
We are starting to see prices tick up, and retailers like Walmart, Nike, they're announcing this, but then other retailers are just very quietly raising their prices. Now, thankfully, we are in the middle of Memorial Day weekend, so we are seeing big discounts, and so it is a good time to take advantage of those sales, even though the prices are ticking up a little bit.
Trey Bodge, Chuck Sievertson, ABC News.
Keeping you connected to your local community with good news and great conversation. Here's Terry Barr with the Civic Media Radio Network.
It's a hit. Milwaukee Brewers baseball cards are being shared in several communities across the state. The partnership is with police officers in Green Bay, La Crosse, Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Madison, and meant to be an icebreaker between the cops and kids. Here's Brewers President of Business Operations, Rick Schlesinger.
Eventually want to do it to more than just the major cities. We're trying to get around the state as best we can and to sort of engage with our friends around the state. We're a statewide team. We're not just a Milwaukee team.
So see an officer, ask for your own comic book style baseball cards featuring all your favorite Brewers players. Until next time, I'm Terry Barr.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. May is Lyme Awareness Month, and we now have the highest number of Lyme disease cases in Wisconsin history. Judith Ruiz Branch has what you should know.
There are 16 confirmed tick species in Wisconsin, but experts are focused on the black-legged tick or the deer tick and the transmission of Lyme disease. Experts recommend taking preventative measures when spending time outdoors, like wearing protective clothing and using insect repellent. They add you should perform tick checks and shower after any outdoor activity. State entomologist Dr. Zia Lee says some ticks, especially the younger ones, may be harder to spot.
Those are usually the ones that we associate with a lot of the cases of Lyme disease or tick-borne diseases, most active in June and July.
The number of Lyme disease cases has tripled over the past 15 years, according to state data. Deer ticks have spread from northwestern Wisconsin to every county in the state over the past 30 years. PJ Leash from the University of Wisconsin-Madison says the increasing prevalence of this species has led to an emerging health threat.
They are still spreading outwards. They seem to be moving into newer areas. In some cases, that can be more like suburban backyards, areas where we haven't seen them historically, and they're still potentially expanding, and we don't know when they are going to stop.
He says if you're bit by a tick in Wisconsin, there's about a 50-50 chance that it's carrying Lyme disease. He emphasizes the risk of Lyme disease transmission increases with the duration of tick attachment, which is why prevention and detection are so important. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tome Olson.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Plenty of sunshine today and a light north breeze, highs near 70. Overnight, mostly clear skies. Lows will drop to the upper 40s. On your Memorial Day, a mostly sunny sky in our forecast. Highs again near 70s. Showers returning Tuesday. It's 69 at our studios.
Jay, Matt, Nair, and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, Todd Alba will be here to break down all the news of the weekend. Kathy Giorgio, whose book has been banned in Waukesha, will join us. Don't miss it.
Matt Nair on air, weekday mornings 9 to 11.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, Lacrosse's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review, and my name is Jim Santel. This is the second hour of our weekend broadcast every week, addressing the major issues in the rule of law and justice and the delivery of justice to America and in many ways around the world, as well as much of our court work these days is focused upon our status and our presence in the international community as well. We know our Supreme Court is a part of that, not only the structure of our government, but also that movement, that effort by all of us to ensure that democracy endures, and the Supreme Court represents one of those structures that provides checks and balances to the other branches, the legislature and the executive branch as well, and also has this responsibility for determining whether the ultimate final decisions of state courts are consistent with the Constitution. And indeed, as a part of our review in this broadcast of Amicus Law Review, talking about three major cases that the Supreme Court didn't decide this past week in connection with the Establishment Clause of the Constitution, prohibiting the Congress, prohibiting government from establishing or doing anything else that promotes, enhances, encourages religion in America. This is once again the idea of separation of church and state. The Supreme Court has in front of it just this past week, as it has had in previous weeks, the oral argument, very colorful, not giving a whole lot of indication about how the Supreme Court could go on this in an Oklahoma case. It stems from this dispute once again over the approval of a Catholic virtual school. It aimed to provide an online school to bring Catholic education to families across rural Oklahoma. And after the state's charter school had been approved by a group of people responsible for reviewing these kinds of things initially, the state's attorney general stepped in and he sued to stop it. And he was arguing that a religious public school like this would violate the First Amendment's prohibition on government establishment of religion and the state's constitution ban on spending public money to support religious institutions of this sort, relying upon the precedent of our nation, again, prohibiting the establishment of religion. The Oklahoma Supreme Court agrees with him. It rules against the school, says you cannot take those monies. You cannot be a part of the public school regime. Majority saying, in these the words of the Oklahoma Supreme Court, it would create a slippery slope that may lead to the destruction of Oklahomans' freedom to participate in the religion of their choice without fear of government intervention. The Supreme Court there went on to say, this particular school is a public charter school, And writing beyond that, that the state law that allows such schools requires them to be non-sectarian. Can't be religious in nature if you are a state public charter school. Under both state and federal law, the majority of the Oklahoma Supreme Court said the state is not authorized to establish or fund St. Isidore. Can't do this. A very clear statement, again, by the Attorney General, the executive branch, if you will, of the state of Oklahoma, and also by the Supreme Court. And when this gets to the United States Supreme Court, again, by virtue of the decision by Amy Coney Barrett to recuse herself, again, that's based upon her affiliation, her knowledge. She has a close friend who was a professor at Notre Dame Law School who's leading this advocacy on behalf of schools like St. Isidore. So Amy Coney Barrett recuses herself, and that leaves eight justices to decide the case. They split 4-4, leaving the question, who's the fourth among the four who said no to the school and yes to what the Attorney General and the Supreme Court of Oklahoma said? An awful lot of speculation in the wake of this, and it may have been John Roberts. The reason why that's so significant is just this. Because John Roberts, as you know from our previous discussions here on this broadcast, has been an advocate for a new and novel and very pro-religious approach to these kinds of cases, and a whole series of cases, decisions by the Supreme Court in recent years. It has been John Roberts who's written many of these opinions, who's also put together majority opinions that say that the question is whether or not the decision by the government, by the Congress, by whatever the entity is whether or not you are discriminating against religion. Is the conduct that you're approving in some way discriminatory against faith groups, religious groups? And if you think about it, what that means is that religious entities will almost always win, because any exclusion, again, based upon the fact, the conclusion that to give, for example, monies to a school, give monies to a church to support construction or other activities of that church, and deciding not to do that, that by its very nature is a low-level form of discrimination, right? And so in virtually all of these cases, in this new standard articulated by the Chief Justice, religion has won. And it's caused an awful lot of people to say, gee, do we still have a separation of church and state? Is that prohibition on establishment still there if, in fact, you can permit the use of monies and other support by a government under all these circumstances, where to do otherwise, to decide not to do that, would be discriminatory? In fact, what he has done in recent cases is to supplant the long-standing standard, and that's been about entanglements. Again, another big word. You all know what that means. It basically, the question is, gee, based upon what's going on here, what is the nature of the government action that is purportedly establishing or supporting or promoting a religion? Is that conduct so greatly entangled somehow, involved in participating in the religion itself, that it cannot stand? Maybe some de minimis, some small nature of involvement is okay. But if the entanglement really does support religion, establishes, somehow encourages that faith, then it cannot stand. That has been the standard, again, until Chief Justice Roberts in recent years came along with this, no, that's not right. That's not the right standard. Discriminatory practice instead. And so it is very interesting to see that if indeed it is the Chief Justice who made his decision to go along with the other three, that he is now in not a majority, not a minority, but presumably looked at this and said that, yes, indeed, this is a situation where the Establishment Clause does prohibit this kind of entanglement between the state of Oklahoma funding through tax dollars of a religious institution, does prohibit that maybe, just maybe, he is altering somewhat his view on the standard to be used in future religious cases. Maybe it was simply that in his own deliberation, this was not discrimination against this particular school. We do not know. But it certainly is interesting to see that a Supreme Court Justice, the chief, who up to now has been very pro-religion and, again, receiving a lot of criticism from many sides for being on the side of beginning to erase the Establishment Clause in the Constitution. Here, he basically affirms it. And again, the language of the Supreme Court affirming the lower court's decision by virtue of a tie at the Supreme Court. That happens in this 4-4 decision of just this past week in front of the United States Supreme Court. Other cases, at least two others, affecting and implying some applications of religious issues and concerns. We're still waiting for those. Those will be coming forth in the next 6 weeks or so. Here on this broadcast, we'll continue to monitor all of that. But this past week, an interesting case not deciding definitively because of the 4-4 split, and also then opening up the door to future cases where the same kind of thing will be tested, likely in the coming term, maybe the term after that. This is not the last word on it. And it may well be that in those future cases, Amy Coney Barrett will not have the recusal issue, which will send her back into a situation where she can deliberate and decide along with her 8 colleagues on the merits of a case like this. Lots of things to come up in this particular issue. First Amendment, once again, on the docket of our Supreme Court just this past week. Also on the docket of our Supreme Court this past week, in yet a third case that's significant, monumental even, when it comes to the authority of the presidency under the Constitution to act. As this president and other presidents in the future may act, we have talked before about this thing called the unitary executive theory advanced by the president a couple of months ago when he issued that executive order saying that if you've got any legal interpretation, any legal understanding of any federal agency, whether it is inside the executive branch or those independent agencies that are out there created by Congress, any determination you make about what the law is that is contrary to the law as I say it is not permitted. Or it may well be that the attorney general will give you an opinion on something that she has to say. That is an invocation of this unitary executive theory that anything that's not that particularly legislative in nature or especially judicial in nature is by its very nature executive in nature. And the president has complete control over, yes, indeed, not only what the law is inside those independent agencies, but also who is hired, who's fired. What is the composition of the leadership of those agencies? Who's in charge? And the unitary executive theory, you should know, not only announced and articulated again in Project 2025, an attempt to codify it in one of those executive orders that the president has issued earlier this year, but now also in that big so-called beautiful bill. It's also incorporated into this legislation that's now being considered now by the Senate of the Congress. It is out there. And indeed, this past week, the Supreme Court, without identifying it by that name, also addressing one consequence of adopting this unitary executive theory where the chief executive, the president, has complete authority over every single agency, including those intended and designed by the Congress to be independent in nature. And so what did the Supreme Court do just this past week when it came to at least 3 different agencies? A bit of a split decision. In the end, a decision that sends both some concerning signals about the future and also at least one right now somewhat satisfying determination about the future of one of those independent agencies. Let's begin with that positive news. It has to do, yes, that's right, with the Federal Reserve and the chair named Jerome Powell before the Supreme Court this past week in one of its major decisions. As we come back here on Amicus Law Review, I'll tell you what the Supreme Court did there and in other agency considerations as this broadcast continues.
You're listening to the Talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM.
Mental health is health care. Self-care isn't selfish, and asking for help is a brave and powerful step. Mental health affects every one of us, regardless of age, race, or background. And yet stigma holds many people back from getting the support needed.
I grew up being called a worry wart, which I've now learned is anxiety.
Kira Sabin gets it. The Madison-based positive psychology coach says many times you just have to let it go.
A lot of the times the energy that we spend trying to control our environments is wasted because we're trying to control things we can't. We can't control the way other people react to us. And trying to just drives us crazy.
This Mental Health Awareness Month, let's break the silence, build understanding, and create a world where mental wellness is a priority for everyone. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, LaCrosse's home for the Todd Allball Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
My name is Jim Santel, and this is Amicus Law Review, our weekly weekend review of all things related to the rule of law and justice and the promotion of a republic through those trappings of our fundamental principles in our Constitution and beyond. Spending some good, considerable amount of time this weekend talking about three things that the Supreme Court did just this past week. Yes, in the areas of the Establishment Clause under the First Amendment, also having to do with the authority of the Secretary of Homeland Security with respect to a temporary protected status of some 350,000 Venezuelan immigrants, and now talking about a decision, a split decision made by the Supreme Court when it comes to the authority of the president to fire the heads, the leadership, the members of the boards of directors of independent agencies, and those are three in number. There certainly are many more than that out there, the three in number before the Supreme Court in particular. Supreme Court talking about something called the Labor Relations, National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB. They are responsible for an awful lot of administrative rule setting and, yes, adjudication at an administrative level of things related to labor in America. No small thing. No small thing. Also, the Merit Systems Protection Board, that acronym is the MSPB. Those are the folks who make decisions about another very significant issue in our national discourse. That is circumstances under which personnel, the employees of our federal government, are hired and fired, terminations, all kinds of things. They review appeals of decisions to terminate employees in the federal government. We have seen a lot of that. We've got those agencies. And then we also have the Federal Reserve. You know that well. These are the folks who, among other things, are responsible for our economic status and our condition, among other responsibilities, many others out there. But the board, including its chair right now, that's Jerome Powell, sets interest rates, right? And those affect dramatically all kinds of things. And because of that, and the nature of, yes, what the NLRB does and what the MSPB does and the Federal Reserve does, all of those created independent of the executive branch. And that's created by the Congress to be independent, because you don't want an executive, regardless of what their political focus and their animation is, you don't want the president to be affecting things like decisions on personnel or decisions on how labor should, in fact, be administered and adjudicated. You don't want a president making decisions about interest rates. All of those things should be done in a nonpartisan, non-political way, based upon what? Based upon the merits of the cases in front of them. In the instance of those two agencies, the MSPB and the NLRB, you want to make decisions inside the Federal Reserve based upon what you think are the best interests of the economic vitality and strength of our nation, not dependent upon what a president may want to do when it comes to things like inflation and other matters related to the cost of living in America. And so this past week, somewhat wrestling with all of those issues, the Supreme Court issues what can only be described as a somewhat of a split decision, giving the president what he wanted in connection with the NLRB and the MSPB, but also saying, keep your hands off the Federal Reserve. Supreme Court this past week basically shielding the Federal Reserve from the president's push to fire some top officials, again, at these independent agencies. And also along the way, saving that when it comes to the Federal Reserve, that because it is a uniquely structured quasi-private entity, that's the language of our Supreme Court just this past week, because of that, Mr. President, you do not have the authority to fire Jerome Powell. Now, the reason why that issue is significant is because in recent times, the president has sent some conflicting signals about his happiness or his disappointment with the chair of the Federal Reserve. He posted on April 17th that Powell's termination cannot come fast enough. And then on April 22nd, a few days later, he said that he has no intention of firing the chairman of the Federal Reserve. Well, all of that, again, in the public domain. The Supreme Court basically this past week saying hands off the Federal Reserve. Why? Because it's a quasi-private entity and it's uniquely structured. And so at least for now, Jerome Powell, who has also maintained very publicly that the president has no capacity to fire him. He has said that publicly. Many others have said that in the commission given the Federal Reserve, it's an independent authorization from Congress. Can't do that. You cannot terminate members of the board. You can't terminate the chair of the board. Powell has said that appears that the Supreme Court agrees with him. And so at least with respect to that independent agency, hands off, Mr. President. But in once again, this unsigned ruling, again, there's the problem. Not a lot of explanation aside from this specific reference to what the Federal Reserve is these days. The unsigned ruling does grant the president the authority when it comes to the National Labor Relations Board and the Merit Systems Protection Board to terminate the jobs of Gwen Wilcox, who is a board member of the NLRB, and Kathy Harris, who's a board member of the MSPB, can terminate their positions. And the order, the decision of this past week, basically extends a temporary decision, again, entered by the Chief Justice way back in April 9th, when he let Donald Trump remove those two and override the job protections that the Congress has created for both roles to insulate them again from White House control. The Chief Justice previously saying, yes, indeed, you can go ahead and fire them. Both Wilcox and Harris had argued that letting the president remove them would leave Powell vulnerable. And the same concept that would involve terminating them would apply to the Fed board and the chair as well. But the court said, again, it's unsigned order, that it disagreed with Wilcox and Harris's contention, number one, that the president did not have the authority, even in this interim basis, to fire them, and also that they are just like the Federal Reserve. And the contention, of course, by Wilcox and Harris was that arguments in their cases having to do with their agencies necessarily implicate, they wrote, the constitutionality of for-cause removal protections for members of the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors and other members of other agencies. Now, what are they talking about there? Well, again, the legislation that establishes all of these independent agencies says, yes, indeed, the leadership, the board members can be removed, but only for cause, some sort of dereliction in duty, failure to do what they're supposed to do, some negligence, perhaps some malfeasance in office. It's a for-cause standard. And here, the representatives of both the NLRB and the Merit Systems Protection Board saying, no for-cause dismissal here just because the president doesn't like us, and that's an inappropriate basis upon which to do it. The Supreme Court previously, from the pen of the Chief Justice, and now again this week, saying that even as the challenges to that position of the president go ahead, once again, the litigation still proceeding at the lower courts, even while that's going on, the Supreme Court this past week telling those members of the NLRB and the MSPB that the president can, in fact, fire them, and that the jobs that they had, those positions they encumbered, can, in fact, be vacated. And they are basically now without jobs by virtue of what the Supreme Court has said, again, on this interim basis. Needless to say, again, without a whole lot of explanation, the decision by the Supreme Court is being blasted from many, many sectors. And indeed, we do get one of the plain dissenters here. Her name is Elena Kagan. She says that permitting the firings, as she describes this, is nothing short of extraordinary. And she invokes a thing called the Humphreys executor case. It was a 1935 Supreme Court case in which the Congress shielded high-ranking officials from being fired, and it paved the way for these independent agencies to go forward and proliferate throughout the government. When we come back, I'll tell you more about that case, what Elena Kagan said, and then we're going to move on to other cases coming out of our federal district courts across the nation here on Amicus, a law review.
Eagle 1490 AM.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. Rescued after a 911 call for a boat in distress in San Francisco Bay. Fire department patrol boats found 9 people aboard a sailboat that was taking on water, 8 rescued. The boat captain stayed on the boat. Fire officials say he's an expert, and he and it were towed in. A dual U.S. German citizen arrested and accused of trying to firebomb a U.S. Embassy branch office in Tel Aviv a week ago. Justice Department says gasoline bombs were found in Joseph Neumeier's backpack outside the embassy. On this busy travel weekend at West Virginia's busiest airport, Yeager International, a second collie now patrolling the mile-long airfield to shoo away birds that could get sucked into a jet engine and cause a crash. Russia and Ukraine swapped hundreds more prisoners for a third day today as attacks in the war continue. This is ABC News.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
The Brewers fall in Pittsburgh. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Baseball for the second day in a row, the Brewers losing to the Pirates. The final yesterday, 2-1 in favor of Pittsburgh. Batters like Milwaukee's Sal Frelick, Bryce Terang, making contact, but the Pirates making good defensive plays in the field. Brewers manager Pat Murphy.
Didn't get the big hit again. Didn't get a hit in a big spot. Frelick hits the ball a ton. Terang puts a good swing on that ball. Frazier makes a great play. You know, we've got to do more than that to beat teams that are playing good. And the Pirates have played a little better here in the last 6 or 7 days.
The Brewers now 6.5 games behind the first-place Cubs in the NL Central. Cubs losing to the Reds yesterday, 6-4 in Cincinnati. The Crew back home tomorrow, first pitch at 1:10, as they open a 3-game series against the Boston Red Sox. Basketball for the 7th year in a row, the Bucks' Giannis Antetokounmpo named first-team All-NBA. That puts him in a class with Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Plenty of sunshine today and a light north breeze. Highs near 70. Overnight, mostly clear skies. Lows will drop to the upper 40s. On your Memorial Day, a mostly sunny sky in our forecast. Highs again near 70s. Showers returning Tuesday. It's 69 at our studios.
An unsuspecting driver at a gas station in Wisconsin.
Welcome, Pump 15. How you doing?
Great.
Were you wearing your seatbelt today?
I never wear my seatbelt.
We're going to get him. We're going to get him real good.
Oh, my goodness.
Hello, sir. How you doing?
Dollar driver. It takes 1 second to strap a seatbelt on. Well, let's do this. Let's do it together. Now, don't that feel better?
Donald Driver can't always be there to remind you.
Click it or tick it.
And let's reduce fatalities on Wisconsin roadways.
And I should have recognized your voice when you were harassing
me. I'm watching you.
Sponsored by Wisconsin DOT.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. The independent state legislature theory met a skeptical U.S. Supreme Court in 2023 in Moore v. Harper, a North Carolina gerrymandering case. The Michigan GOP tried to employ the fringe theory to undo Michigan's Question 2 citizen ballot initiative, but the U.S. Supreme Court refused the case May 19th. Proponents argue the independent state legislature theory gives legislatures ultimate power over federal election rules based on a widely dismissed interpretation of the election clause of the U.S. Constitution. In North Carolina's case, the legislature admitted it gerrymandered but said it had the final say and the courts and governor had no jurisdiction. In 2022, Michigan's Promote the Vote Question 2 ballot initiative passed 60% to 40%. It enshrined multiple voting rights in the state constitution, including 9 days of early voting, guaranteeing the right to vote without harassment, offering a permanent vote-by-mail list, and mandating drop boxes and several other important voting reforms. 11 GOP legislators tried to invalidate the ballot question using the ISL theory. They argued that only the state legislature could make election law, not those pesky constituents. The Michigan Supreme Court dismissed the case in April 2024, and on May 19th, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear the case. We have more on ISL and the Michigan case at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Todd Alba.
Hey, everybody. Join us next time for a very special Memorial Day episode. We talk to Jeremy Lyon from the Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs on our cemeteries, honoring our veterans, and more. Join us.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays 2 to 4.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santella. We are continuing in this, the second hour of our weekend broadcast, to talk about the major things that the Supreme Court has done just this past week, including in this significant, it's very wonky, I know, but nonetheless, a significant case involving the future of independent agencies in America. We've talked a lot about that in the past. These are independent agencies established by the Congress to be just that, to ensure that their decision-making process is premised upon facts and the law and the application of regulations established by the Congress and enforced by these agencies, independent of partisan involvement and political thought from the White House. Well, this past week, again, the Supreme Court chipping away at that independence by saying, with respect to the Federal Reserve, yes, keep your hands off. That one is indeed quasi-private. It's uniquely structured. Cannot fire the Federal Reserve chair or members of the Board of Governors there. But as to the MSPB, the Merit Systems Protection Board, and the National Labor Relations Board, there, in fact, you can indeed, at least preliminarily, get rid of some members of those boards that you do not like. Again, this is an unsigned order, and the Supreme Court goes on to say that it's not making a final decision. Again, litigation continues, still at a very early stage, but as the litigation continues, the Supreme Court says, yes, indeed, the executive branch, the president, can indeed fire these two, and goes on to say that the president can, in fact, remove without cause, without reason, without justification, based upon their actual performance, can remove without cause officers who exercise powers that are in the nature of an executive, subject to some narrow exceptions that do not apply here. That's a big statement to make, even in this very, very skeletal kind of docket. We once again have some authority in this area. It has to do with a case called Humphrey's Executor. It's 1935. And in that case, the Congress did, in fact, shield some of these high-ranking officials from being fired by a president who didn't like what they were doing. And it paved the way once again for the establishment of more of these so-called independent agencies. It is invoked by Justice Elena Kagan, who's not happy with what the Supreme Court has done this past week. She blasts the court decision, and she says that this is nothing short of extraordinary. She said it allows the president to overrule the decision in Humphreys by fiat. By fiat, she said the decision has forced the majority to create a bespoke, but by that she means a particular custom-fitted exception for the Federal Reserve. She basically says this makes no sense. And although, again, we do not get a lengthy opinion, frankly, no opinion at all, we do get some sense about the dissent inside the Supreme Court on this issue. It will be back. It will be back down the road, as will these other matters that we've talked about involving, once again, First Amendment issues and certainly immigration issues with respect to deportations being undertaken by this president. All of that happening before the United States Supreme Court this past week. Lots going on. We're going to be spending a lot of time in the next 5 to 6 weeks on this broadcast, analyzing, pulling apart the other major decisions. There are about 35 of them the Supreme Court has yet to issue among its docket of about 65. They're going to be coming out in a flurried speed this coming month or so. And again, every weekend we'll be pulling apart those major cases and talking about them here on this broadcast. We necessarily also talk about the major decisions coming out of another branch of the federal courts, if you will. Those are the federal district court judges. We've got the trial judges. We've got the appeals court judges. And then we have the Supreme Court. Those are the three levels. Trial judges, the district court judges, 93 districts around the country. They continue to be very active, very active. And as I've said before, others have said the same. They are the guardrails. They're the ones who right now are hearing these cases involving challenges to various executive orders issued by the president in all sorts of things, including, yes, indeed, including things related to education and including things related to deportations. Judges, the district court judges, are almost to a person, not completely, saying to the president, you can't do this, or at least preliminarily, it appears that you should not be able to exercise the authority that you do seem to want to exercise. And they're enjoining, they're stopping the president from going ahead with these executive orders while once again the litigation proceeds, eventually leading to trials in all these cases. We've got three more instances of those just this past week, among many others that are taking place. We've got this involving education, one of two education cases. I suspect you know what the other one is. It involves Harvard University, but this one involves the Department of Education, a federal judge. His name is Myung Jun. He is in the U.S. District Court of Massachusetts, and he issues, yes, indeed, a preliminary injunction. This one is big, and he blocks President Trump's executive order doing what? Dismantling the Department of Education. And that order also directing officials, again, that is the judge's order, directing the officials there to reinstate literally thousands of fired federal employees from the Department of Education. We know that just this past week, Linda McMahon, who is the Secretary of Education, told the House Appropriations Committee that as many as three quarters of the roughly 2,000 staff members of her agency, of the Department of Education, have lost their jobs. They're no longer there as a result of the Musk team efforts to reduce government as it impacted the Department of Education. Well, this past week, again, a challenge to that huge reduction, a challenge to the president's order to begin to ramp down what the Department of Education is all about, entered by Judge Jown at the U.S. District Court in Massachusetts, a preliminary injunction, and remains in force until the case is resolved at a higher court or the judge himself overturns it. Again, likely it's going to be appealed again to the appeals court, maybe ultimately makes its way to the United States Supreme Court. This particular case, it is the product of some school districts in Massachusetts, the American Federation of Teachers, and some attorneys general who said that the president's March order to prevent the Department of Education from going forward should in fact be blocked. And the court should reverse this massive round of layoffs. The judge agreed with those arguments and said that the actions equated to, as he said, an illegal shutdown of the agency, which only the Congress can abolish. Congress created it. Only the Congress can bring it to an end. He said this, the record abundantly reveals that the defendant's true intention, the defendant meaning the administration and the president and the Secretary of Education, their true intention is to effectively dismantle the department without an authorizing statute. The judge had previously entered, again, some orders directing that the Trump administration release about $65 million in some teacher training grants. You may recall that. We talked about that as well. Turns out that an appeals court upheld that order, but the Supreme Court in April overturned it. And so those dollars, those teacher training grants, those are not being sent on to school districts around the nation. We'll see what happens in this connection, that is the future vitality of those jobs at the Department of Education, the basic vitality of the entire Department of Education now in the dockets of our federal courts. Presumably, we're going to go to an appeals court reviewing what Judge June has done here, and we'll also presumably one day get at least a decision by the Supreme Court about whether or not to review those decisions, about whether the president has the capacity to bring to its conclusion a federal agency, this one not independent, this is inside the executive branch. Can you bring to conclusion an agency properly authorized by the Congress without Congress saying we're now going to end that agency? The judge saying you need legislation to do that. The president saying no, he can do it by virtue of executive order, which is what he has done. Again, more rule of law, more checks and balances, more division of authorities and responsibilities with which the courts and all of us wrestle. That's coming out of the Department of Education. We know as well that there are other matters coming out of the Harvard University matter. You know this well. We've talked about this at great length. We've talked about the battle between Harvard University and the President of the United States of America. The administration early on announcing that it's going to rescind about $450 million in research funding to the school, and also directing that the school stop doing various things with respect to admissions, hiring policies, personnel audits, shutter its diversity programs, its equity programs, its inclusion programs, and a war has ensued. Not a battlefield war, but a war between the president and Harvard University back and forth. Harvard filing a lawsuit claiming that what the president is attempting to do is a violation of their First Amendment rights to teach, to speak, to assemble, to advocate for positions, and also a violation of something called the Administrative Procedures Act that requires that these kinds of things, that is the rescission of grants and of programs and directives, can only be done, at least initially, through an administrative process, that the president has not followed that. All kinds of allegations made initially. The Harvard University lawyers have already amended once their petition, when indeed the president has upped the stakes on all of this and further indicated that he is going to stop various funding levels to Harvard. And indeed, the war, the battle has continued this past week as the Trump administration says it's halting Harvard's ability to enroll, that's right, international students, halting Harvard University's ability to enroll students from foreign nations, taking aim once again at a critical funding source for the nation's oldest and wealthiest college, and also plainly affecting dramatically this large portion of the student body there at Harvard. Could affect about a quarter of the students total of this total student body of the school. And this again comes after back and forth in recent weeks between all of these issues related to Harvard University and its compliance with what the president wants it to do in all of these other areas. The lawsuit, again, is further amended. And indeed, the lawyers for Harvard University go back into court. And indeed, they file a complaint on Friday in Boston denouncing this latest move with respect to international students as a blatant violation of the U.S. Constitution. The university warning the decision would have an immediate and devastating effect on the institution and more than 7,000 students who are there getting an education on visas. And here, once again, we've got more judges involved. Yes, indeed, as late as Friday, U.S. District Judge Allison Burroughs, she is once again there in Massachusetts. She issues a temporary restraining order to halt the implementation of the policy. She enjoins, she stops the president from going ahead with telling Harvard that it can no longer enroll international students through the administrative processes of the federal government. This is also involving Kristi Noem, because this is accomplished by the federal student visa program. If the visa program says that these students can no longer be there under Homeland Security, their capacity to be present here in this country is rescinded. Their capacity to be educated at Harvard University is also removed. And all this raises all these questions about the school certification, all kinds of things related to this decision to revoke student visa program opportunities. An awful lot of people out there saying this is not only unprecedented, but the use of the Department of Homeland Security to reshape a student body of a university, revoking access to the vetting systems there. It's unique to targeting this particular institution that certifies, again, who these students are every year is unprecedented, many people are saying, and plainly now going to be the subject of more litigation in the federal courts, including in front of the judge, Allison Burroughs, who has stopped its enforcement. So at least for now, those 7,000 students at Harvard, very uncertain, very unclear about their future, not only their student visas, but whether they continue to be enrolled in Harvard, very uncertain, but at least for now. In this weekend, this Memorial Day weekend, when we think about all things American and our presence on the planet and the good things that come from a diverse population there at Harvard, and yes, indeed, at every other college, university, trade school, two-year colleges and universities and other institutions around the country, the good things that come when we have people in these settings who are diverse and who are there because we invite them to be a part of our unity
and the significance of education that comes from all that. It's really being tested by all of this. Now we've got a federal judge who has said that indeed that's the reason why this can happen. It cannot happen as we go forward. When we come back, a couple more.
You're listening to the Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Matt and Air on Air.
This is the story of the one. As a lineman, he does whatever it takes to keep the power on in his community. And he wants a partner like Grainger who does the same. Grainger offers the professional-grade products he needs, from voltage detectors to harnesses to hard hats, plus fast, dependable delivery, so he can rise to every challenge. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
Hans Breitenmoser, we have people in Congress right now cutting food assistance.
All of it is a disregard for how the economy actually works. When you plant seeds in the ground, you get money close to the ground. That's what makes rural economies work. Urban economies are very similar in that regard. Washington is only as good as its participants, and we've got some real dandies there these days.
That's definitely one way to put it.
Catch Mornings with Pat Kreitlow at its new time, weekdays 6 to 9 on Civic Media and the Civic Media app. This is the talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a lot of you talking about the work of the federal judiciary, Supreme Court, and now the district court judges. Three other cases among many, many this past week, one involving a decision by a federal district court judge in Massachusetts to stop the administration from denying Harvard's ability to enroll international students. We've got another judge also saying that the chief executive cannot go ahead with another of his executive orders, that one trying to mothball to bring to its end the Department of Education. Yet we've got a third one getting back once again to this all-important issue related to deportations. Here again, another federal judge, his involvement in these cases having to do with immigration, and in particular a judge named Murphy, who finds, in fact, this past week, Brian Murphy, that the Trump administration had violated an order of his that he issued last month, barring officials inside the executive branch from deporting people to other countries not their own. And that's the key to this, without first giving them an opportunity to object to their removal to those nations. This is the so-called South Sudan case that you've heard a lot about. The finding by, again, Judge Brian Murphy, he's in Massachusetts. One of the strongest rebukes of this administration. Basically, he has previously said that when it comes to decisions to deport a particular group of people, and indeed we've got eight people in this particular matter, they're from Cuba and Laos and Mexico and South Sudan and Burma and Vietnam. They've previously been convicted of crimes, and those crimes are heinous. Their murder and sexual assault and robbery, other things. There's no doubt that our system has resulted in judgments against them, finding them guilty and also finding them deportable. And the judge saying that before you do that, however, you've got to provide them with notice and opportunity to object to their removal to nations other than their countries of origin. And that's the rub. That's the reason why this is back in the news. Judge Murphy saying that you have violated, by virtue of sending these eight, and you know the story here, arguably to South Sudan, arguably to the East African nation of Djibouti. We don't know exactly where these folks are right now. But because you have done that without conferring with them and without giving them due process with respect to where they will land, what country you are taking them to, that is expressly contrary to what Judge Brian Murphy entered, the order, the directive he has given to the Homeland Security Department early on in this year. And he said that the administration's violation could ultimately result here in a finding of, yes, that's right, criminal contempt. Criminal contempt. We know that there are other judges who have likewise proposed the same thing. The judge has asked, Brian Murphy has asked the Homeland Security Department, and yes, Kristi Noem once again, to quickly determine whether it was possible to hold hearings for those eight men while they remained in U.S. custody overseas. What can we do to ensure that the process, the due process about their relocation to another nation is followed? And what is Brian Murphy's point? Brian Murphy's point is not to suggest that these people, their judgments should be overturned, not to suggest that the deportation proceedings, which otherwise afforded to them, have not been given to them in an incomplete way, but it's indicated to them, to the Homeland Security and to them as well, that due process procedure is not complete because the notices and the information you've given them, the opportunity afforded to them to defend against their removal to a country other than their own has not been afforded to them, and that's the point. And so Judge Murphy is looking for an opportunity here still to find a way if he can conduct those hearings, perhaps overseas, in a way that will give them the due process that what the Congress of the United States of America has established for the Department of Homeland Security in all of these cases. He is enforcing the law. He is not doing what the press secretary said just late this past week, violating the law, interceding in international affairs in a way that he has no authority to do. That's not the case. He is enforcing the very law, the process that, yes, indeed, is given to people who are convicted of crimes, also ordered to be deported, even that process established by the Constitution to be enforced by the federal judiciary in this country. That's the rule of law. That's due process. That's all those things of equal protection in our Constitution. Judge Murphy said that it's not immediately clear what he's going to do if he finds out that indeed his order has been violated, but he is intending to find out. And he asked for a list of names of people inside Homeland Security, inside the government generally, who are responsible for violating what he feels is his order, telling them that they've got to provide this due process to these eight people. He said, I want the names so I can notify them that they might all face, as he said, criminal contempt penalties. And as we've said before, what does that involve? That involves certainly fines upon the federal government, which is stunning, certainly some limitations in future litigation, and yes, indeed, the possibility of detention until that contempt is somehow purged. These are not simple things being said by this judge. We know Judge James Boasberg, the chief judge in the District of Columbia. Paula Zinnes in Maryland has said much the same thing. We know that there are other judges. Stephanie Gallagher has likewise indicated the government may well be violating her orders in refusing to comply with what she has said in connection with all sorts of immigrants, migrants who are facing deportation and not being afforded the due process that is required by what? By the law. The law not created by them, passed by Congress to be enforced by them, but to be followed by an executive branch that repeatedly is not doing just that. That's the concern. That's the rule of law concern, and that is why, for example, one of the appeals courts in adjudicating some of these cases has said it is becoming far too common in all these cases that we are being confronted again with the efforts of the executive branch to set aside the rule of law in pursuit of its own goals, those goals partisan and not consistent with the rule of law, which gets us back finally to Memorial Day and the reasons why all of this is so important. When I was in Iraq for 2 years, I saw on a daily basis the soldiers who were there, many of them going out every day to battle the wars there on behalf of our nation and the other nations in that conflict, to do it to preserve, again, not just in Iraq, but around the world, the kinds of things that we've talked about on this broadcast today and the kinds of things we continue to talk about in furtherance of our nation's integrity, the notion that everyone, regardless of whether you're a citizen or resident, is entitled to due process. That's the reason they died, and that's the reason they gave up their lives to sacrifice for us and the future of a nation that continues and should continue to embrace in 2025 all of those key principles upon which we're founded. We'll come back again next week and talk more about all that. For now,
you're listening to The Eagle
WLCX, La Crosse's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabe.
Pat Kreitlow.
On Monday, we'll rebroadcast some recent clips as we take time off to honor Memorial Day and those whose sacrifices gave us the freedom we continue to defend.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, weekdays 6 to 9.
When a parent sees their child smile, they see hope. Aleem hoped that his son Rajib would have an easier life than he had. You see, Rajib, just like his father, was born with a cleft. But thanks to Smile Train, both father and son received free, life-changing surgeries, transforming their smiles into symbols of hope. To learn more and support the global cleft community, visit smiletrain.org/learn. Smile Train, changing the world one smile at a time.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us. Soaring high above La Crosse. This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse. And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. Arrested and accused of trying to firebomb an American embassy office in Tel Aviv, a dual U.S.-German citizen. Justice Department says gasoline bombs were found in Joseph Neumeier's backpack. Events nationwide today mark 5 years since George Floyd, a black man, was murdered by a white cop in Minneapolis, sparking protests across the country. Despite the Trump administration moving to drop court-approved agreements to enforce police reform, this from Minneapolis Police Chief Brian O'Hara.
With or without consent decrees, there is more that we need to do to reform this police department and rebuild it to ensure that we can be as effective as we possibly can while continuing to rebuild trust with our residents.
Russia and Ukraine swapped hundreds more prisoners today. Rescued after a 911 call from out in San Francisco Bay, fire department patrol boats found 9 people on a sailboat that was taking on water. This is ABC News. With advice